Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active in off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road. This episode of Conversations with Big Rich is brought to you by the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame. The mission of the Hall of Fame is to educate and inspire present and future generations of the off-road community by celebrating the achievements of those who came before. We invite you to help fulfill the mission of the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame. Join, partner, or donate today. Legends live at ormhoff.org. On this episode of Conversations with Big Rich, I'll be talking with one of the biggest names in off-road, a true legend, a great storyteller, a 2006 inductee into the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame, a 2020 inductee into the Motorsports Hall of Fame, the man behind the moniker Iron Man. Yes, Ivan Iron Man Stewart. Hello, Ivan. It's so great to have you on the show. I've been wanting to do this interview for a long time, and I'm really looking forward to this, and I'm glad we were able to make this work out. So thank you for coming on board.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate you thinking of me and looking forward to telling you some of my adventures that I've had over the years in off-road racing and off-road pre-running and everything that goes with it.
Well, I think you're one of the supreme storytellers. I listened to you at a conference there at SEMA where you did a talk, and I was really, you held me captive. I have to say that. You held me captive with your stories.
Well, I think one of the reasons for that is, you know, off-road racing, desert racing anyway, is, you know, is an event and it's a race. But for me, when I was racing and even today, the pre-running and the adventure of racing down there and pre-running is the real story. It's kind of, you know, I've always kind of thought the race was almost secondary because, you know, I couldn't wait to do the adventure of driving night and day through the wilds of Baja and all the things that you see and all of the obstacles that you have to overcome and how quick you can overcome those obstacles. If it be rain or snow or cattle or a forest fire or you name it, then you have to, the quicker you can maneuver that, the more better your odds are for winning the race. But always an adventure for me.
Absolutely. And so, and I found that just pre-running myself, you know, going down with different teams to help their cause. And I look forward to getting down there again. It's been a couple of years since I've been down there, but I'm hoping this year maybe I have the time.
Well, I've liked it so much that we bought a house down there. In fact, we're going down again probably next week to our house just south of San Felipe and then doing a drive down to Cabo San Lucas just to see a lot of the friends that we've made over the years and just to drive down to Cabo and come back again. To me, it's a real adventure.
Right. Just another adventure in life. That's awesome.
Yes, sir.
So let's get started and let's find out where you were born and raised.
I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My folks were from there, obviously. And then we moved from Oklahoma when I was only about 5 years old or thereabouts to San Diego. And then I was raised around San Diego, El Cajon and La Mesa and Alpine and all those little communities around the San Diego area. And if you know that San Diego and Orange County is probably the heart of off-road racing. So I raced go-karts as a kid, so I was kind of familiar with racing when I became later in years when I get into off-road. But yeah, San Diego is where we grew up and I raised our kids in that area.
So in those early years, I know San Diego, you know, now is a pretty metropolitan area as well as, you know, of course, LA is like the premier metropolitan area, but What was it like? I would imagine that back in, you know, in those early days, that it was much more of a rural feeling.
Oh yes, absolutely. Well, the off-road racing part of it, you know, in the 60s, where I first started hearing about off-road, late 60s, 67, 68, somewhere through there, you know, it was completely different. I mean, it was the really an adventure off-roading, because people didn't have GPSs, and they didn't have good tires. They didn't have good shocks. They didn't have all this stuff that you can buy. You can go down today and buy a vehicle right off the showroom floor and go right drive the whole Baja 1000 with no problem. You know, in those days, in the 60s and 70s, you know, you didn't have the good lights, and you didn't have the GPS and all these things. So it was even more of an adventure. And I was intrigued by it by talking to my friends, for example, Lynn Chenneth, who was one of the first guys that raced the Baja 1000. And the stories that he told, I just knew I had to find a way to do that.
Right. And when you were in school, those school years, were you like a great student, or were you one of those kids that looked out the window just waiting to get outside?
No, for sure. I was one of those kids that was waiting for gym and gym class, the auto shop, and to get outside. And I wasn't a very good student. It didn't come easy to me, studying and everything that went with that. I just knew that I knew how I wanted to make a living, and it wasn't off-road racing. And I just figured that I really didn't need a lot of the things that they were teaching me in school to do this occupation that I wanted. But no, I was definitely an outside kid.
So you mentioned athletics, PE. Did you play sports?
Yeah, a little bit, not a whole lot. Probably football more than anything. You know, and track and field, I was a pretty good high jumper and pretty good runner, but mainly football and a little baseball, but not a whole lot. It was, you know, I was more intrigued. I think what I really probably wanted out of life in my high school days was to grow up, get a job, and start a family. And I never really didn't think much about racing, other than I did race go-karts when I was probably 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. My dad got me a go-kart, and we raced ironically, a lot in Mexico on the airport in Tecate. It was a great place to race. I did an endurance race in Ensenada, on the streets of Ensenada, in the 50s, in about 1956. So I was kind of obviously getting more familiar with racing, not off-road, because off-road hadn't even started yet. But the go-kart racing got me acquainted with how to race and, you know, what it took to race. And I wasn't intimidated by it. I was excited by it more than anything. So, yeah, I had some experience in those early days in racing, but not really even thinking about professionally or off-road racing or any of that. But it was more fun, I think, at that time.
And you said auto shop. So you spent a lot of time in the shop classes and learning to work on cars yourself.
Auto shop, metal shop, you know, anything that was, you know, affiliated with building and in fact, I'm still kind of that same way, as I enjoy getting things accomplished and building and working on my house in Mexico and what. So that kind of got me started in that direction.
And what did your dad do as a profession?
He worked at the U.S. Grand Hotel in downtown San Diego as an engineer. So it was a problem-solving job for him, and I loved to go down there with him in the early days in the 50s and spend time walking around downtown San Diego. And in those days, it was really, you know, a much safer place to be than it is in this day and age. So I walked all over San Diego. I knew downtown San Diego pretty good by the time I, you know, 12, 14 years old.
Right. And so then what... Did you have a job early on, like through high school or right after high school? What was your first job?
Yeah, when I was 16 years old, I got my first job and bought my first car for $125, a 1940 Ford. I wish I still had it. But I loved working on that thing and, you know, driving cars and still during that period, it wasn't nothing to do with off-road, but I love driving. I like the freedom of driving and the, just the experience of going someplace new and all those things like most kids. But, you know, I think it's a little bit different today because I don't think the kids are quite as into driving as I was in those days when I was 15, 16 years old. But I loved it.
Yeah, I think the newest generation, especially those that are, maybe 32 and under, as a majority, not saying all of them, of course, but as a majority, aren't interested in the same things that we were.
No, the independence and just the thrill of, you know, a friend of mine tells me that, you know, he's told me this story a long time ago and I believe it, and it is crystal clear true. An automobile is so cool because if you think about it, you can get in your car and you can set that radio station to exactly what you want. You can set the heater just the way you want it. If you want to see mountains, you just drive up to the mountain and look out the windshield of your car and you see mountains and trees and all those beautiful things in the mountains. And if you want to see the beach, you drive down to the beach and you see, looking out the window, you get to see the beach. And getting there is an adventure. So, I mean, if you think about it, an automobile is a pretty cool way to get around and all the different things that you can. If you like racing, you can go race your car too, you know. So, you know, I thought that was kind of a cool way to think about it.
But, you know, I look at it as an automobile is the tool for destination or the adventure of getting to that destination. You know, it's the process of getting there that is so exciting.
Yeah, and then you take it to the next stage, and if you get into off-roading, now you get to go on. You know, I live in Flagstaff, Arizona now, and there's thousands of forest roads to explore up here. And you can do the same thing anywhere. You can do off-roading, now you get that another dimension of driving.
Right.
And the reading the terrain and all the things that go with that people don't think a lot about. But eventually you'll learn to read the terrain and be aware of what's coming up even before you get there. That's all part of off-road racing and off-road driving. And then to take care of your vehicle, if it's a race car or if it's a SUV, you still got to take care of it.
Right. No, I agree. I put on a race. We had a national finals for our dirt ride endurance racing, which is kind of it was like a feeder series for King of the Hammers. And we were doing this in Texas. And after the race was done, I asked my wife if she wanted to drive the race course. And so she says, okay, yeah, let's do it. Well, we started up on this ledge and then it dropped off this ledge, pretty good drop, and then down into this quarry floor. And it was solid rock floor. And the race cars had gone and kicked out all the loose stuff to the edges.
Yeah.
She drives off the ledge, did great, turns and then hits the throttle. And proceeded to hit, I think, every single, you know, rock out there. And about halfway across the quarry floor, I said, okay, stop. She stopped and looked at me like, what's wrong? And I said, well, first of all, we're just driving the race course. We don't have to race the race course. Secondly, you don't have to hit all the rocks. So I had to teach her how to read the race course. Or read the terrain and what was in front of you, not look at, you know, the farthest distance point that you can see and drive to that. Drive in front of you. You know, figure out what's in front of you and what's coming.
You better believe it. There's a lot that it took me a long time to learn in off-road racing. Little things that I slowly picked up along the way that were real key to successfully navigating a course, but it takes a while.
Right. So let's talk about that very first race that you had. I think it was in 1973 and the Ensenada 300. Am I correct?
Yeah, correct. You got it. I, there was a high school friend of mine that I had, a guy by the name of Bill Rinko. And, he started getting me kind of interested in off-roading and off-road racing somewhere around the late 60s, probably maybe even in the 70s. And And then, like I say, I talked to Lynn Chimith about doing, he raced the Baja 1000. And Lonnie Woods was the guy that used to own the Rough Country Shocks here in San Diego. And he had raced. And I, and the more I talked to these guys, the more I was intrigued with it. So Bill came to me one day and said, Ivan, I want to build a two-seat Chimith off-road race car. You want to help me with it? And I said, yeah, sure. What can I do? You know, he said, well, just help me assemble it and put it together. And then I'll let you ride with me. So I signed up. So yeah, this would be great. You know, let's go for it. So I did a couple races with him riding as a co-driver, and I really hated it. I actually hated the riding because I thought I could do a better job and I could read the train maybe a little quicker than he could. And I got on him one time because I told him, I said, Bill, you know, the objective is, I got tired of changing tires. I said, Bill, the objective is to miss these rocks.
Yep.
Because I think a lot of people focus on the rocks and then they aim for the rock. And that's, I don't know why they do that, but I've heard that the people will just be focused on something and ended up hitting it. But anyway, so we were going to do this Ensenada. I think it was called the Ensenada 300 or Baja 300. I think Baja 300. And it was a 300-mile race in a big loop around south of Ensenada, down by San Tomas is where it actually started. And so anyway, a couple of days before the race, he calls me. He says, Ivan, I just got back from the hospital and I broke my leg and I'm in a cast. We got the race coming up on Saturday. He said, you're going to have to drive and I'll get Earl Stahl to ride with you. So, I mean, that was fantastic. I mean, that was my golden opportunity to do something in off-road racing and drive. Because I had three boys and mortgage payments and cars to take care of that I couldn't afford a race car at all, you know. So anyway, we started the race and, you know, I didn't have any experience in racing other than I had a burning desire to do it. So within the first probably 2 or 3 miles, I slid off the road into a ditch and now we're laying on this road up on the side. So I ended up running back to get some on the course from the race car back to some guys that were pitting, talked them into coming down and getting me back on the road again. So now we're running last. We're the last car on the road. So we get the car back, get going again, and we started catching people. But about another few miles down the road, the throttle linkage broke. So I ended up, the cable that would go from your foot to the carburetor had broke. So I decided I could pull that cable out real quick, wrap it around a crescent wrench, and I could drive with one hand operating the throttle, the right hand, and I could steer with my left hand, and I could work the brake and the clutch with my feet, obviously, but the throttle with my right foot wouldn't work. I had to use my hand. And then Earl could shift for me because this was a Volkswagen-powered buggy, right? So I couldn't shift because I'd have to drop the crescent wrench, and then I just couldn't do it. So he shifted for me, and we were all screwed up. But we got better and better at it. And so, you know, like I say, it's a 300-mile race, so, I mean, we had quite a bit of time to catch people. Pretty soon, we're starting to catch cars and pass cars. And make a long story short, we ended up winning that race. And it was my first race I ever drove, and I won it. So now I was really addicted to this. So then the next race we had, I don't remember what it was. Bill's still in the cast. And he said, well, you go ahead and drive. You're doing good, you know. You won a race. And so then the next time, I think we finished second. I forget what it was. So that's kind of how I got my introduction to driving off-road. And I got addicted not only to driving, but I got addicted to winning. That was the real thrill. And I love the adventure of it. So that was kind of my first takeoff on winning and racing was the Ensenada 300 in San Tomas, Baja California.
And what were the markings like back then? We talked about not having GPS back in those days. And, you know, all the technology that we have nowadays, what was it like trying to chase those race courses without GPS?
Well, it was a big deal because if you could afford to, if you had the time and the money to pre-run, sometimes they'd mark the courses. This, I'm talking about real early 1970 now. They would mark the courses so you might go down the day before and do a pre-run and try and remember the course. And then they, once in a while, they'd give you some down arrows. A down arrow would be a danger ahead. But what would happen a lot of times is the cattle would knock the trees over where the ribbon was, or the little girls, the little local Mexican girls down there would take the ribbons and put them in their hair. So you never, when you got the green flag, you never knew exactly where the course was going to be, especially if you didn't get a chance to pre-run. Or if you pre-ran, now you had to remember the course. Maybe you and your co-driver could pre-run together. But, I mean, it was a real adventure just getting around the course until you had made a couple laps, and then you could remember pretty much the danger spots and where the intersections were. But the better you were at doing that, the more successful you were going to be, because if you could read the terrain, as I mentioned earlier, and realize that there was a ditch coming up, or how sharp a corner was just by the berm on the outside of the corner would tell you how sharp the corner was. So, I mean, there were just a lot of things that you had to learn, but it was, like I say, without GPS and all the good headlights and, you know, technology, it was a real adventure to get around 300 miles down there.
Right. And what for you is the biggest attraction of racing in Baja?
Just the adventure. Because I have never, when I say that, I'm saying even a pre-run, you've been down there pre-running. Typically, you cannot go down there and do a pre-run, or certainly not a race, without something's going to happen to you.
Right.
You're going to have a flat tire. You're going to slide off the road. Like you say, your wife goes down a hill, goes too fast, scares the heck out of you, and you're trying to teach her how to drive. And I mean, it's so everything about it is just, you know, there's something going to happen to you. You may not happen to you, but you're going to come across somebody that's slid off the road. You need to get them back on the road. Their car broke down. You need to tow them because you have to take care of each other.
Right.
You can't, even in a pre-run or especially a race, I mean, somebody's turned over, you got to, you know, help them make sure they're not hurt anyway, if nothing else. So, I mean, you learn to take care of each other, and there's always something that's going to happen. I've never been down there ever that some crazy thing happens to me in Baja. Not necessarily a bad thing, but an adventure. How do I get out of this? How do I get back on the road? And how do I, you know, get out of this ticket? there's a multiple. You could write a book about things that have happened to people just going to Mexico, much less not going off road.
Yeah. I one time, one of the lessons that I was taught early on, and it was by Pistol Pete Sorin, because I helped his team, was that if you get stopped or if you get the police turn the lights on you before you get to the Highway 1 toll booth, you just keep driving until you get to that toll booth.
Yeah.
And especially if it's the local police. And the first time I came in there without being in the caravan, that happened. And I drove quite a ways, a few miles, until I got to that toll plaza, and the guy shut his lights off and turned around and went back into Tijuana. And I learned a valuable lesson that day.
Yeah, there's multitude of stories that I've heard, and a lot that I've had several times where luckily I've been recognizable, where I've been pulled over by the police, and only because they wanted to get an autograph.
Or stickers, yeah, right?
There's great stories from not only myself but my friends that have got tripped up with the local police. But just if you get stopped by a cop and the red light comes on, okay, the first objective is to, okay, how am I going to get out of this, right?
Right.
That's the first thing. At least that's on my mind. And it's the same thing with driving. You're driving in an off-road race and it starts to rain like crazy. So how slick can you be to get on down the road better than your competitors? Or if it snows or if the wind blows or you get into silt, it's all the same. It's how quickly you can get out of the situation and continue on down the road.
So you told a story in that at SEMA one time when I listened to you speak. I think you were like a keynote speaker. It was at night, no GPS, and you thought you pretty much knew where you were going, but you saw headlights like way out in front of you, and they were coming at you, and you thought, boy, that guy's lost. Do you remember that story?
I keep going a little bit.
Okay.
I'm trying to think about what time this, when did this happen? But go ahead. I'll get it.
So you told the story about how you both came toward each other and, you know, it took a while because, you know, it's night and you're out in the wilds of Baja and the lights would disappear and then they'd come back. And finally you guys met up. And I think it was, it may have been, it may have been Walker Evans, and you came up and saw each other and you both went like, you know, well, you're going the wrong way. No, you're going the wrong way. And, I guess you guys got it figured out, but the way you told the story, I was just like, I was entranced. I mean, it was great. Well,
I do remember this. I haven't heard that, told that story in a long time, but yeah, that was a nighttime race. And you know, you've been down there at night. I mean, if you're in Mexico, there's not too many lights. If there's no moon, it gets dark. I mean, it really gets dark.
Right.
So this race, it wasn't Walker. I don't remember who it was. But yeah, in the distance, you see somebody coming towards you. And he must be on the same road as you because there's no other roads out there. It's a dirt, one-lane dirt road. And he's a mile away from you, but you can see his headlights. I can see his headlights. And when we finally got to each other, you have to realize that one of you are screwed up. So you're hoping he is, but it could be the other way around.
Right.
Did I tell you the story? I got a good story that I've told a lot, that when I was racing with Charlotte Corral and Coco Corral in their Ford truck, Charlotte and I were going to do the Baja 1000 all the way to La Paz together. And then she was going to ride with me and we were going to make it all go all the way to La Paz. And she loved to ride. And her husband, you know, he chased and paid the bills and all that. But at any rate, we had a lot of problems. I mean, early on, I mean, the distributor gear broke. And then we had a flat. And then it went on and on. And we were way, way, way behind on the course. They got down to below San Ignacio. And I knew that we were kind of getting screwed up. We were kind of turned around or something didn't feel right that I didn't. Now, you know that when you do the Baja 1000, it goes to La Paz. It goes from Ensenada to La Paz, which is pretty much south, kind of southeast, but you're going south. You're definitely not going north, right? So the sun starts to come up, and I couldn't figure out. I'm trying to analyze in my head, why is the sun rising on my right-hand side? So finally, I slowed down, and Charlotte said, what are you doing? Why are you stopping? I said, Charlotte, The sun should never be rising on our right hand side if we're heading south. So I'd gotten actually completely 180 degrees turned around and going the wrong way. I don't know how long I was going the wrong way, but anyway, that's how screwed up you can get in Mexico.
Right. And luckily now everybody runs GPS, but you know, those early days, you know, a 1,000 mile race could be 1400 for you.
Yes. Yeah. It was always an adventure.
So you won driver of the year four times and they were in a row, weren't they?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Somebody asked me the other day how many times I won the Met. And I said, I think three. They said, nah, you're like five or six. I don't remember.
Well, that's a good thing. You have so many you don't remember.
It's a nice thing, yes. But driver of the year, I think probably in class eight, class two. I don't remember. I know it probably with Toyota also. Toyota didn't come until 1984. But I'm sure you're right. If you saw it somewhere, I'm sure that's right.
Okay. And then in 1976, you were voted in as Man of the Year.
Yes.
And that, I'm not sure what was that because of things that you had done besides, like driver of the year's wins and all that.
Yes.
And man of the year goes beyond that.
Yes. I think it was probably because I was involved in a lot of things. I donated a lot of time to doing some talks and things that going to the hospital or whatever it might be they asked me to do. Because I was so, you know, enthused with what I was able to do. At that time I was still working as an iron worker. But I did have an opportunity to race off-road race, and that's what I really wanted to do. So I was so proud to just be doing that that I was volunteering for everything. Yeah, I can do that. I can do this. I can do that. I can do a talk for somebody or whatever it was. So I think that's probably the main reason.
Okay. And then your nickname, Iron Man.
That came from, that was in the 70s. It had to have been around 1975, somewhere through there when I was driving a single seater. I started in two seaters, and then I wanted to move up with the single seat cars were typically winning overall, and they were the one that were getting a lot of recognition. And I wanted to get into a single seater. So Valvoline put up an award to anybody that could race the Baja 500 or the Baja 1000 and win. They would win $500 from Valvoline. And then they would also have this big trophy that was made them the official Iron Man of off-road racing. So I was the first to win one of those trophies and the $500 and the second and the third. So then Mickey Thompson and some of the journalists started tagging me the Iron Man of off-road racing. Although other people over the years have also won those trophies, you know, but I was the first to do it and got the first three.
And I understand that you kept yourself in really good shape, that you worked out so that you could have that endurance. Is that correct?
It is correct. But I went in the 70s before I got driving for Toyota in 1984, 83, 84, I was in construction. I was an iron worker, and I worked a lot in construction. I was in good shape without having to go to the gym.
Okay.
And then later on, I had a trainer that I worked with, a couple of different guys that I worked with that kept me in pretty good shape. And that really paid off. I think that really paid off in the long run.
Right. I would imagine, especially when you're driving, you know, doing that Ironman style by yourself.
Yes. Yeah. But there was also, you know, what happens too, Rich, is that you learn, and I'm sure you know too, you learn to drive off road without using a lot of energy. You know, so if you can drive without really, really wearing yourself out, you know, that's another secret. You know, I rode with my son Brian one time when he was driving for Walker, when he first started driving Class 8 up in Barstow doing some testing. And right off the bat, I told him within the first mile, I said, Brian, stop for a second. See, you're working way too hard at it, you know, and he just had a death grip on the steering wheel, and he was just putting way too much energy into it. So tried to help him just kind of relax and feel the car and you won't get so tired, you know. So that there was a lot of secrets and things that I learned along the way. So as I got into my, you know, into my 50s, and I could still be pretty competitive off road.
Right. And so, when did how did that early transition go from running, you know, basically kind of a privateer to being Toyota?
Well, that was pretty spectacular, because we were one of the very first to, and it all started with conversation, I think, in 1983 when Cal Wells called me. He had been building some of my Class 8 full-size truck. Class 8 was a full-size. In those days, it was a Ford truck that I had, and I drove for Joe McPherson in the Chevrolet truck. And he called me one day and said, you know, I'm putting a bid in or a proposal into Toyota to race this Mickey Thompson series. And he explained it to me, you know, Mickey Thompson is going to come and put these races on inside stadiums. And, you know, I want to build a mini truck. And I just, as soon as he said mini truck, I'd already been driving big trucks, Fords and Chevrolets and winning races and building a reputation that I could drive those trucks. And now when he said mini truck, I said, well, what? I'm thinking to myself, well, that doesn't sound very attractive to me. I says, well, what kind of motor are we going to have? He said, well, we got little four cylinder motors. I said, Cal, I really don't have an interest in, you know, doing that. That's not something I really want to do. But knowing Cal Wells, he gave me all these figures about, well, you know, horsepower to weight ratio, and, you know, and we're going to do this, and we'll build you something special, and Toyota's going to get really involved. And so, yeah, when that happened, I really probably, I didn't really think it would be near as big as it was. When he said, "Oh, by the way, we have to go to a press conference down in Torrance at Toyota's corporate offices." But when I went into their corporate offices, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to their place.
No.
They're in Torrance, when they were in Torrance, a beautiful, beautiful place. And all these journalists showed up, and Steve Millen and I were going to be teammates in two trucks. It was a huge deal. So I realized that maybe that was probably a good decision. And with hindsight, that was the best decision, off-road racing decision that I've ever made. So yeah, that was the start of something huge. And we wasn't doing desert racing at that time. It was just stadium racing. In fact, for the first year, I drove a Ford in desert racing and drove a Toyota in stadium racing. Then I won the championship in the stadium racing. And that's when Toyota said, no, we don't want you driving a Ford. We'll build you a desert racing truck.
Okay, there you go. So they, from stadium then to desert with Toyota.
Yes, because if you think about it, Cal Wells already had a big shop to build the stadium trucks and maintain those trucks. And you've got the people there and the engineers and everything. It really wasn't going to cost a whole lot more to build a desert truck, although it's, you know, it cost a lot of money to campaign them. But anyway, that was how that all started.
Okay. And those early years I'd equate it to like the rodeo cowboys, the stadium trucks.
Yes.
You know, going yes. into a town or a city and racing in a stadium. I know Barbara Rainey talks about working, you know, for Mickey back in those days, and was her and another mm-hmm. lady would go in a couple of weeks ahead of time with a couple of rolls of quarters and a phone book, and then set up so that the races could even happen. And mm-hmm. it just amazes me the stories that she tells, because, you know, there was no internet. There was not the convenience of being able to find anybody anywhere now, like it is nowadays. And I would imagine for you drivers going into a situation like that, where, you know, it's all about the spectator, where Mexico, it's more about racing the terrain. The spectators are just going to show up. But there, yes. you know, the stadium, it's all about the spectators. It's like a baseball game or a football game. You're doing it for the spectators.
That's right. That's exactly what it was. And Mickey Thompson was a genius in a lot of things. I mean, he would... We did Riverside for the first time, and I remember that the first race that we did there, that, I mean, there wasn't 30 people in the stands, but he got up in the back of the pickup during the driver's meeting and said, "You guys, you may not believe me, but I'm going to tell you, one of these days you're going to see both stands filled up." And we all looked at each other like, "Okay, Mickey, we're here to race." But Then he says that, and then in Riverside got to be huge. In fact, we put more people in the stands at Riverside probably 5 or 6 years later than NASCAR put in there. So he would, if he told you he was going to do it, he was going to do it. He said, We're going to race. We're going to take our trucks and buggies, and we're going to race the LA Coliseum. Then we're going to jump out of the peristyle and jump through the peristyles, and it's going to be spectacular. But he would do it.
Right.
And he took us to Dallas. He took us all over to Pontiac, Michigan, all over the place doing this stadium racing. It was fantastic. But I wouldn't miss that part of my life for anything.
So what was that like, dropping down at the Coliseum from the top up there and dropping down into the stadium? Was that, I mean, I would imagine that was just out of this world. I mean, I don't even know if I have the words for it.
Yeah, well, just racing at the where the history of the LA Coliseum had was just fantastic. And then to go through it, but I'll tell you, a lot of people ask me the same question. But going up the grandstand, jumping through the arches was harder than coming out because it was a narrower. If you look at it, sometimes to go through it was narrower. And at that archway where we went through. So you had to really get lined up. And if somebody bumped you or something going up the hill before you jump through the peristyle, you're gonna hit one of those concrete barriers. But whenever you came back down and made the left to come jump out, it was pretty simple because you wasn't going as fast, for one.
Okay.
And you just jumped. All you had to really worry about is that you didn't jump so far. Your truck wasn't handling where you might do an endo. I mean, that was the biggest thing you had to worry about. Or you didn't want to jump so far that you landed flat on the racetrack down. You had to, you really wanted to land on the downhill part. But no, that was, it was harder going up and jump through the peristyle and coming out. Okay. But it was a thrill, always a thrill.
And when did the video game that you're, that's so famous come about?
Well, that, that was about 1985, that was the worldwide. And I still stay in touch with a good personal friend of mine, the guy that John Rowe, who owned the company at the time, and was part owner of the company that manufactured that arcade game. But so it started in about 1983 or 84. I had just done a stadium race in San Diego, and I'd won that night. And the next day or the next week, I was at a little sushi bar in El Cajon, California. And I heard these guys, young guys down to the right of me, talking about how excited they were about going to the off-road race and the stadium race and jumping and the crashes and everything that came with it. And then I heard them talking about this arcade game that they were working on. Kind of over, I overheard them, and I went over and I introduced myself. And they couldn't believe that Ivan Stewart was in the same sushi bar. Sometimes you hit the timing just perfect, Rich. You
know? Right.
And this was perfect timing. So anyway, I introduced myself as Ivan Stewart, and they couldn't believe it. They shook my hand, and I said, I heard you guys talking about this arcade game. Tell me more about it. Anyway, they went into detail what they wanted to do, and I said, well, I'll tell you what I'd like you to do is introduce me. Can you set up a meeting? I'd like you to introduce me to your boss, you know, the guy that's in charge of doing this game, because maybe I think I could probably help you with some, you know, information on how the truck should jump and turn and handle. And I just knew that I wanted to be a part of that. I didn't realize it was ever going to be as big as it was. So I went over and met John Rowe. We hit it off, worked up a contract, signed the contract. They could use my name. I said, well, look, you can use my name, but I really want you to use the picture of my truck, and I'll be responsible for getting an okay to use all the, you know, the sponsors that we had. We had some pretty good sponsors there. They obviously Toyota, and I don't remember the rest of them right now. But so anyway, got that ball rolling, and I went over, made 4, 5, 6, 8, maybe 10 different trips to their facility and helped them for whatever I could with programming, because these were computer programmers. And this was all in the early days of, you know, computers and stuff. I mean, this was all new. I didn't know anything about it, but these young kids that I was working with, I would help them with on how the truck should be handling, how it should look, and how it should jump, and this and that. And then, lo and behold, you know, before long, it came out, and it became number one, like I say, in 1986. So it was a great part of my life. I mean, I'm still good friends with John Rowe, and I got one in my garage that I keep here just for the fun of playing it once in a while.
Wow, that's awesome. I know that every once in a while somebody will post up, you know, that there's one on Marketplace or somewhere, you know, for sale, and they never last long when somebody puts one up for sale.
Yeah, they're pretty rare to come by right now. Yeah, it's hard to find them.
So then, with all your racing as a racer, you end up becoming a promoter, and you come out with the Pro Truck series or Pro Truck class.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it's what I would call a driver's class, because everything was, you had to use certain engines and certain chassis and certain tires, correct?
Correct. Yeah. They were all the same chassis, all the same suspension components. The only difference was that if you ran a Toyota body, then you run a Toyota motor. The motor had to match. Ford body, Ford motor. But no, it was really competitive. It was something that, this is where, you know, you make mistakes in life once in a while. I've made a bunch of them. But I figured that the trophy trucks were getting so expensive, and hard to, you know, you had to have engineers to help you build them, where it was going to be real popular to make just a turnkey class. It was a driver's class. And I didn't want to be a promoter. I wanted to be just the sanctioning body. So if you were promoting a race, I just wanted to bring my trucks to you, and I'll be the sanctioning body, and you promote the race. So it worked great. It was a great time I mean, went all over the place, ran them up in, at Laguna Seca on part asphalt, part dirt. We went to Guam. Larry Ragland drove one up in the Perry Dakar. And I mean, it was just great because I could take them anywhere I wanted to. So, yeah, no, that was, it was really a fun time. I mean, I learned a lot. I wouldn't do it again, but I would. It was fun to me, not so much fun for my wife, but I had a great time. I had a great time doing it. She had to pay the bills.
She was the one that wrote the checks.
Yeah,
I know how that goes.
Yeah,
I'm the dreamer in the family.
Yeah, right. Well, you got to have a dream. You got to have a dream come true. You got to have a dream, right?
Right. So true. That was class six at SCORE, correct?
Well, it was just the pro truck class.
Pro truck class. Okay. Know,
it was just, that's what I wanted. I just wanted to promote the pro truck series. Actually, it was a series where I could go to any promoter if they wanted me to, you know, basically wanted 10 or 12, 15 trucks. And most any promoter would say, yeah, heck yeah, bring in 15 trucks. They get the entry fee. So it was, you know, you understand all that, how that works.
Right.
But yeah, I just liked it. I took it to Pikes Peak. And because you can, I still love the fact that an off-road race car can race off-road very successfully, but they can race on-road. But you can't take a road racing truck and race it in a road racing car and race it in Mexico, you know.
Correct. Very true.
That's why I'm so proud of one of the reasons I'm so proud of off-road racing.
I agree. And the technology nowadays, it's accelerating so fast with, and it's interesting because, like, you know, being a rock crawling promoter and into rock racing, what we call rock racing, so off-road racing, but with the extra thrill of throwing in huge boulders,
yeah,
and rock formations and trails, that, you know, the technology, we stole technology from off-road racing and just kind of inverted it, took it from the high speed stuff and made it so it worked going slow.
Sure.
You know, going the coilovers and link suspensions and all that kind of stuff. And then when the rock racing happened, the guys realized, well, you know, independent suspension, you can go faster, smoother.
Mm-hmm.
But now how do we make it survive in the rocks?
That's right.
And how do you make it survive?
Always a challenge.
Right. And now, you know, I remember that, you know, except for the factory, like the Blazers and the Broncos, you know, there wasn't the Dodges, there wasn't a lot of four-wheel drive, go fast desert rigs. You know, I think the one I always remember is the Landshark. And then
which one?
The Landshark, the Herbst.
Truggy. Yeah, right. Right.
But then you know, you get the KOH guys, you know, trying to create that straight axle front end to go faster and faster and faster. And then, you know, they start playing with IFS.
Mm-hmm.
And now, mm-hmm, you know, it's IFS and IRS, so four-wheel independent. And now, right, Mason, you know, has taken that and perfected it for the trophy trucks.
That's right.
You know, there was, you know, nobody would throw a four-wheel drive trophy truck out there because they couldn't make them last.
That's right.
And now, look what's happening. So it's the marriage of all of it, you know, and that technology going in a big circle.
Well, I think probably 10 or 15 years ago, way before four-wheel drives, trophy trucks were available, I think a lot of people knew, including myself, and the reason we knew is because of Dakar, the Perry Dakar. You knew those cars were four-wheel drive, and they were going to be the quickest. If you could develop an off-road truck, a trophy truck with independent front and rear four-wheel drive, you were going to win races, but it cost a fortune, a tremendous amount of money to develop it.
Right.
Just to go out and test and break things and test and build things. But once you got it down, and that's where they're at right now, you just buy a Mason truck, buddy, and you've got a piece little, you know, really go the distance for one, and it's really fast, you know. So, it all comes around. It just takes time.
Right. So let's talk about some of the other things that you were involved with beyond the racing, like the Special Olympics and Make-A-Wish.
Yeah, over the years, you know, especially when I was driving for Toyota, because I wasn't working anymore. I was just racing and doing whatever they asked, basically whatever they asked me to do. So there was a lot of opportunities to go to do things with the Make-A-Wish Foundation and, you know, all those different things that you can do. Public speaking, a lot of that over the years. And, you know, and Mickey Thompson's the one that really, I think, that really helped me out in the early days when he took me aside and said, Ivan, you know, that Toyota's going to do this, Mickey Thompson series. You're going to be asked to do a lot of public speaking, probably things that, you know, you don't want to do, interviews and this type of thing. So he said, you need to go down and do a Dale Carnegie class. And I did. And it was probably one of the best things I did for my racing career anyway, was learn how to get in front of the camera and be, you know, relaxed with it, and interviews like this one and that we're doing, and public speaking and all. Because I was always terrified of that. I wanted to race off road. I didn't want to talk about it.
Right.
So anyway, he really helped me in the early days. He helped me in a lot of ways, actually. But no, it was, you know, it was always fun to do. It was always a challenge. And I committed to do a one coming up in Sacramento for the Land Cruiser Club of America or whatever it is, something like that, to go up and talk about off-road racing and what have you and some of the things that I've done. But, you know, I do it because, you know, one of the things I learned is feel the fear and do it anyway. So I've kind of done that with my life, is so there's little fears involved. Go do it anyway. So I committed to do it.
And working with the Special Olympics, that's pretty touching, that and Make-A-Wish. You know, that's
they're all rewarding. You know, they're in different ways. They're all fun to do. They're certainly worthwhile for your time. And if people think that you're, a star or an athlete or a celebrity and they want your autograph, I mean, that's just all part of the business. And I'm overwhelmed by it once in a while and humbled by it, but it's still fun.
And then you work with a school for the deaf in Ensenada?
Yeah, for 10 years, my wife and I, Linda, put together a motorcycle ride. We ran across this little deaf school in just outside of Ensenada, between Tecate and Ensenada, called Rancho Sordomudo. And I got to know the people that ran this little deaf school, because they off-road raced, and they knew me, obviously, and invited me to come down. And my wife and I went down and kind of fell in love with the place and started putting together a motorcycle ride, like a Harley ride or a street bike ride. It started in my shop and went down to the Rancho Sordomudo, this little school, and they put on a play for us and showed us some sign language, and everybody just fell in love with the place and the little kids that were super special, you know. And then we spent the night. They did a presentation for us, and then we spent the night in Ensenada, and then we rode the motorcycles back. We did that for like 10, 11 years. I think I forget the number, but way over $100,000 that we had donated to this little school.
Very good. Very good.
Really fun.
So one of the questions that I have is, and I guess it's a multiple part question, but it's during your years of racing, there was probably situations where you, or times of it, a season where there was somebody that you had to race against that you just knew you wanted to beat them more than you wanted to beat anybody else that's on the race course. Was there somebody like that? And if so, what was their name?
Oh yeah. Well, certainly would be Parnelli Jones. Parnelli Jones on a pedestal for way before off-road racing started, because he could do Pikes Peak, and he could do road racing. He could do Indianapolis. He could do midgets. He could do sprint cars and win. So he was my hero. And then when he came to do, off the Baja 1000, and I think his first race about 1967 there about, then he ended up winning that. Then he won the Baja 500. So I thought, God, I just love to ride with him someday. And I did get a chance to ride with Parnelli, and he went on my trip with me. Walker and him went on my Rancho Sordomudo deaf school ride. and went snowmobile riding with him. He got to become a really, really a good friend. So to beat him would really be at the high point of my life. But it was pretty hard because he was ahead of me, and I didn't get a chance to race against him so much. Walker Evans was probably the one that I really wanted to beat, that we raced together in stadium racing and also in desert racing. So probably Walker mainly. You know, he was always tough, but there's a whole bunch of guys out there. Larry Raglan, I mean, there's guys that I raced against, Roger Mears in stadium racing, that were always going to be tough to beat, and good racers that weren't what I consider guys that would run into you on purpose to spin you out and stuff. These guys were all just really professionals.
They wanted to race you clean.
I'm sorry?
They would race you clean.
Race you clean. That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. Just the clean racers. They're always fast, always drove hard, but clean.
And I guess getting close to wrapping this up is you were inducted into Ormhoff, the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame, in 2006, and then into the Motorsports Hall of Fame, which is all-encompassing, in 2020. What were those instances like?
You know, just always super special. I mean, I think it's funny because I'm sure everybody thinks the same as I do. Eventually, that when you go into a form of racing, you don't even dream about, you know, anything that far out there, being into a Hall of Fame and have that kind of recognition. All you want to do is race. And if you could just finish the race, it'd be spectacular. And then someday, if I could finish in the top three, that'd really be cool, you know? And then if I could win a race, God, that'd be the ultimate. I don't care what kind of form of racing. And then it would be a championship. Well, just about the time you win a couple of championships, somewhere in there you think, God, I'd really like to be in the Hall of Fame. And that's way reaching out there. I mean, because you just don't walk up and say, hey, I want to be in the Hall of Fame. People have got to vote for you. And it's a big process in both the Off-Road Hall of Fame and the Hall of Fame of America. But yeah, it's special, super special to be in with a group of people that, you know, in both of those Hall of Fame. So it's, you know, what else could you ask for? I got everything I wanted out. What else can I do in my life other than enjoy it now?
Right. And what would your words be to somebody that walks up to you and says, hey, Ivan, I want to get into off-road racing. What do I need to do?
Well, most people in their life handle that question a lot. And most people, I say, well, how much money you got? You got enough money to buy a race car? Well, usually it's no. Well, I tell them, well, I'll tell you what I'd do. If it were me, I'd go out to an off-road race and I'd find a team that's winning, that you want to be involved with, and go introduce yourself and volunteer your time. Start off as a volunteer. I mean, that's probably 90% of the, close to 199% of the people getting involved in any sport is volunteering their time to learn the terminology. You know, you think about it, you know, if you're going to be a golfer, there's a lot of terminology you got to learn. Same in IndyCar racing or NASCAR racing or off-road racing. So once you learn the terminology and you're willing to work hard and, you know, do what they ask you to do, whatever it might be, clean the shop or, you know, there's great story. Walker Evans has got a guy that started with sweeping the floor and has been with him for like 35 years now and never had another job other than working for Walker Evans and started sweeping the floor. Right. So volunteer your time, get involved and, you know, go for it.
And your family, do you want to talk about your family that, you know, you had a family before you started racing?
Yeah, sure. Well, my wife, Linda, and my oldest son is Brian, and Gary and Craig. And Craig is really involved, my youngest one, in building race cars, servicing race cars, prepping them, and down in El Cajon, California. Stewart Raceworks is his business. My other son, Gary, he kind of gets around in different types of business. Spent a lot of time in the automotive service riders and things like that. And then my oldest son, Brian, who lives in Flagstaff, with where we live now, and he raced for years and did made his living driving in movies and stunt cars and, you know, performance driving and that type of stuff. He drove for Walker Evans for a long time. And now we've had a great life. All of us, the whole family has been, you know, deeply involved in off-road racing and off-road.
Excellent. And that's, I guess you can't really ask for more than that. You know, that was a dream and you made the dream come true.
Yeah, we did. We certainly did. And the timing is so important. As I mentioned earlier, that sometimes you hit the timing. I happened to be at the perfect time and the perfect spot to have the Ironman name, for one. And I knew Cal Wells because he had been prepping some other cars for me to get involved with Toyota. That was probably the biggest, best thing I did for timing was, but all of them. I mean, everything was a good time for me to get involved.
I'd like to say thank you so much for spending the time and having this conversation with me and sharing your life with me and our listeners. And I want to say that it was a great opportunity for me to finally get to talk to you and not have to worry about other people asking you questions. I got to ask you all my questions. So I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you thinking of me and being on your show, and be sure and say hello to those guys on the board there at the Off-Road Hall of Fame, especially Frank Arciero. I haven't seen him in a while.
I will do that, and I'm sure he'll listen to this.
Okay, Rich. Good talking to you.
All right. Ivan, Iron Man Stewart, thank you so much for taking the time. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message, and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.